Genesis 3:1-24. I'm going to be using a little different translation than you have. I'm going to be using the New Jerusalem translation. I felt the wording was a little more lively and fit my topic better. So Genesis 3:1-24. Now the snake was the most subtle of all the wild animals that Yahweh God had made. It asked the woman, "Did God really say you were not to eat from any of the trees in the garden?" The woman answered the snake, "We may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, God say, you must not eat nor touch it under pain of death." Then the snake said to the woman, "No, you will not die. God knows, in fact, that the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like gods, knowing good from evil." The woman saw that the tree was good to eat and pleasing to the eye, and that it was enticing for the wisdom that it could give. So she took some of its fruit and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together to make themselves loincloths. The man and his wife heard the sound of Yahweh God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from Yahweh God among the trees of the garden. But Yahweh God called to the man, "Where are you?" he asked. "I heard the sound of you in the garden," he replied. "I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." "Who told you that you were naked?" he asked. "Have you been eating from the tree I forbade you to eat?" The man replied, "Was the woman you put with me. She gave me some fruit from the tree, and I ate it." Then Yahweh God said to the woman, "Why did you do that?" The woman replied, "The snake tempted me, and I ate." Then Yahweh God said to the snake, "Because you have done this, cursed be you of all animals, wild and tame. On your belly you will go, and on dust you will feed as long as you live. I shall put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. It will bruise your head, and you will strike its heel." To the woman he said, "I shall give you intense pain in childbearing. You will give birth to your children in pain. Your yearning will be for your husband, and he will dominate you." To the man he said, "Because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate from the tree of which I have forbidden you to eat, cursed be the soil because of you. Painfully will you get your food from it as long as you live. It will yield you brambles and thistles as you eat the produce of the land. By the sweat of your face will you earn your food until you return to the ground as you were taken from it. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return." The man named his wife Eve because she was the mother of all those who live. Yahweh God made tunics of skins for the man and his wife and clothed them. Then Yahweh God said to them, "Now that man has become like one of us, in knowing good from evil, he must not be allowed to reach out his hand and pick from the tree of life too, and eat and live forever." So Yahweh God expelled them from the Garden of Eden to till the soil from which he had been taken. He banished the man, and in front of the Garden of Eden he posted the great winged creatures and their fiery flashing sword to guard the way to the tree of life. May God bless his holy word. So, wonderful to be speaking to you today. The last time I was here to speak was obviously a much different occasion. It was Bodley Nugent's funeral. And obviously this is a much different event. I'm proud to be here, proud that I was asked. In fact, when I was approached to speak, you know, I was first a little kind of shocked. And then sort of after I got over that, I said, wow, that would be really interesting. And I thought, well, okay, this is a great opportunity for me to share some of my thoughts about what I've learned as a Christian, what things mean a lot to me. And I hope that some of those thoughts are useful and valuable to you as well. So when you're sort of presented with this challenge, you have to say, well, you know, what do you speak about? What is really going to bless the congregation in the most powerful way? And I started to think back about some of the verses that I remembered. Particularly the ones that meant a lot to me when I first became a Christian, and what things sort of stuck with me in a way that transcended the factual, the facts of a particular verse. So obviously here we have a case where Adam and Eve are thrown out of the garden, and there's all this drama and the snake and so forth. But to me, this story obviously has a much more transcendent meaning, a much more profound meaning, and I believe it has a profound meaning for everyone, and that's what I'm actually going to be talking about. So that's why I chose this verse, which frankly you've probably all heard before. It's something that you've certainly is a prime verse in the Bible. It's a little scary to be picking something that everyone's heard, because effectively the challenge there is to prevent something fresh, so people are blessed from your thoughts on these particular issues. So, I picked Adam and Eve. I picked their expelling from the garden. Obviously, this is a tremendously important story. It's the first humans that appear in the Bible. And it's tremendously early in the Bible, Genesis 3. I remember first really being struck by this verse when I was at college. Not actually a true Christian at that time. And I remember being in class and hearing in a literature class, obviously you cover the Old Testament as part of the Western heritage of literature, and reading that story and being struck by it in a way that didn't make sense to me. Obviously, the professor had all sorts of technical analysis about it, talking about it as an historical document or as an example of historical writing, and all this sort of very... academically oriented discussion about this verse. Obviously, Columbia being a fairly secular university, so there wasn't a lot of spiritual discussion about it, but at the same time, it kind of stuck with me. It stuck with me in an odd way. I found myself sort of thinking about it 3 months, 6 months later, having heard the verse and sort of looking down at the street from my apartment, or walking, you know, in the subway, or just sort of sitting and watching people working, and I remember just feeling like, that it's kind of weird when a story that you had heard in a classroom really speaks to you in a circumstance that doesn't really make any sense to you, and that's what really kind of got my brain going. I started to say, gee, here's the Bible speaking to me in a way that an ordinary document would not. And telling me something about myself that an ordinary document would not. And I think that's really what I'm going to try and get across today. So I would say for me this document was profound. It was profound because it says things that it didn't intend to say, or at least it did not say overtly. It spoke beyond the facts of the actual event and taught me things about myself. And of course, it was written thousands of years ago, and miraculously, it still has a tremendous meaning for me. So there are actually four things that I wanted to discuss related to this this particular passage. And I'd like to go through them, and I'm going to explain why I believe that these thoughts are tremendously profound for us today. The first example of why I consider this to be a tremendous passage is the question of why did they eat from the tree? Okay? Obviously, they were in Eden. They were provided with everything. They had it, you know, as they say in the vernacular, they had it made. And why did they feel they had to eat of the one tree that they weren't allowed to eat? And I'll tell you, that type of thought I see over and over again, even in today's world, where as an adult, there are certain things that you're really not supposed to do, or in places you're not supposed to go, and thoughts you're really not supposed to have. But at the same time, you see it over and over again that those are the things that often entice people. And that's one of the examples of what I actually saw and how that passage particularly spoke to me. The particular quote is from the serpent: "The day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like gods, knowing good from evil." And I remember just coming back to that: you will be like gods. And, you know, I was just like, wow, okay. I mean, I see that in so many places where I don't even know what to do with that as a human being, because I'm so immersed in the world that we have today. Knowing good from evil. What is it like not to know good from evil? What is it like not to know evil? Obviously, that was the state that we were originally in as God created us. It's not our state now, but that was our state at that time. And I honestly believe that in some ways that's the state God really wants us to be. But it's a constant struggle for us as Christians to say, well, what does it be like to live not only not doing evil, but not even knowing evil or not even entertaining evil? I know you don't hear about that a whole lot. Maybe it's not a topic that comes up, certainly not at the dinner table. But that's really what this story is telling us. And the reason it's so important, and the reason it's obviously the first story of anyone in the Bible, is because it's really foundational to the entire rest of our lives and the entire rest of the Bible. I mean, the first thing, what does it look like not to know good from evil? The first thing we're told is that if you don't know good from evil, you don't know what it is not to have any clothes on. Okay? Because obviously they had no clothes on, and because they didn't know good from evil, it never occurred to them. And the first thing that happens when they know good from evil is they put clothes on. Okay? Now, I'm not saying we should run around with any clothes on, but what I am saying is that somehow our world is different than the way God originally intended it to be. And it started right away. As soon as they found out good from evil, their behavior changed. My guess is that Adam and Eve knew good, but they didn't know evil. So they probably knew what good was, but they couldn't contrast it with anything. So they just knew good, and therefore they didn't know evil. And obviously, that is sort of what God intended us to be. And then the second aspect of that is you will be like gods. You will be like gods. I having dealt with obviously many, many non-Christians, as you have in our lives, I think the biggest challenge that we have in reaching out to people, and the biggest roadblock people have to becoming Christians, is wanting to be their own God. Wanting to be gods. Not wanting to submit to God's laws. Not wanting to submit to the fact that they shouldn't do evil and they shouldn't want to do evil, and God doesn't want to do evil. But the bottom line is that is a tremendous stumbling block. And every time I talk to somebody or I'm working with somebody, there's always something in the back of their mind that they still want to do that hampers them from really realizing the new life they could have in Christ, because they can't get away from the fact that they won't be their own God anymore. And my experience, and personally, and when I talk to others, is that if I can find out what that thing is, but you know, they hold on to it so tightly, and I know I hold on to it so tightly. And how do you break that? How do you say, if you let go, if you don't be your own God anymore, there is so much life for you, but they hold on. That is another part of why I think they took the fruit, because they wanted to be like gods. They wanted to be their own gods. And unfortunately, that's an aspect of myself and probably all humans that we all struggle with. The second aspect I want to speak about is the reaction that Adam and Eve have to this mistake that they've made. That they can't undo, they can't go back and pretend they didn't eat it, they can't put back the knowledge of evil. So effectively, and this I remember was just so terrible, but typical, right? You know, Adam's response is, it was the woman you put with me. She gave me some fruit from the tree, and I ate it. And, you know, I've heard that so many times. And I remember, you know, just thinking, oh, he can't even at least admit that he's made a mistake. He's got to blame somebody else, right? I mean, that's just human 100%, right? And then recently, I didn't even kind of put it together, because I'm maybe not that, I don't know, I just didn't put it together. But Adam manages to blame the woman and God at the same time. Okay? It's like he's doing this. He's pointing at the woman, and then he's pointing up at God. And he's blaming them both for him eating the apple. Because he says, it was the woman you put with me. Okay? So it's the woman that you gave me that's caused me to eat that apple. I mean, I know it's very hard to admit a mistake, but this is a classic, folks. You don't often get to blame God and someone else at the same time. And he does it elegantly, but also shamefully at the same time. And again, that speaks to me too. That speaks to my own inability to admit error, for certainly. And Eve says, Eve comes out a little better. She doesn't blame God. She just blames the snake, right? The snake tempted me and I ate. So at least she's not blaming God in this. But again, she doesn't come out and admit her wrong either. And once they eat, a lot of excuses, no, nothing, you know, no good ones. No real remorse, no real upset. And that of course speaks to me, okay? Then we have the third aspect, and that is the consequences. Because obviously, they've eaten the apple, they've blamed other people for them eating this wrong apple, and then we have the consequences. And God comes down with the consequences, and they're pretty bad, okay? Let's not sugarcoat this thing. It's bad. First consequence is the snake. I don't know why he starts with the snake, but snake gets the first consequence. And of course, the snake is the devil. How did the snake get there? Why was the snake there? You know, I don't know. It's really something that doesn't... I'm sure there are whole sermons about why the snake was there. I personally don't understand them. All I know is the snake was there, and I don't need to know anymore. Okay, I don't need an explanation of everything. That's another thing that there actually kind of relates to this story, that something you just need to accept. You don't need to have an explanation for everything. So the first thing, okay, so the snake, his consequence is, on your belly you will go, and on dust you will feed as long as you live. So the interesting thing here that I'm getting is that the snake didn't always look like a snake. A snake didn't always slither around, because obviously the snake that we know now that's slithering around on his belly was not originally what the snake did, because that's the consequence of what he did. Again, I wouldn't have thought of this, but I was reading something and they like said, well, the snake must have looked really good back then. He must have been somebody that you talked to or whatever. I don't know. Adam and Eve didn't seem to mind that the animals were talking, so, you know, it didn't surprise them. So again, this the snake that we see now is probably not the snake that we saw before. Then the consequence to the woman. Basically, childbearing pain, you know, I'm sure my mom could give you some talk about that, but, you know, I'm sure every woman who's had a child will tell you that that's really not a good thing, obviously. And then the second part of that is your yearning will be for your husband and he will dominate you. That's what it says. I think there's something profound there. And then the man. And the man's consequences actually relate to the woman too. So it's sort of a double consequence. By the sweat of your face, you will earn your food. And you're going to die. And obviously the man and the woman are both going to die. They're not going to die right away, which I think is sort of the little double entendre that the snake is saying, that Eve says if we eat it, we'll die. And the snake's saying, no, you're not going to die. Well, you're not going to die right away is really what the snake is saying. And again, a good example of the way the snake kind of twists things around. But then they're banished. They're banished from Eden because they can't eat from the tree of life. And as you remember at the end of that, they actually guard, he puts a guard in Eden so they can't get back in there and eat from that tree of life. And that's really the focus of the rest of the Bible. Because originally you got the tree of the good of evil and the tree of life. And when they eat of the tree of good and evil, they're kicked out so they don't eat of the tree in life. So basically, at that point, you got, they eat the forbidden fruit, they blame other people for them eating it, and then they get the consequences. Okay? And then we have the fourth thing that I got out of this. And that is that there are basically three historical periods. Basically, after Eden, after they get kicked out of Eden, everything goes downhill. Right? Cain kills Abel, first murder, boom, right off the bat. I think within the chapter or two. Okay? That's not a good start. One brother killing the other. Then you got things get terribly wicked. God has to do a flood on the whole thing and wipes out almost everybody but Noah and his family. Obviously, he was not happy with the way things were going. Then Moses comes along, has to rescue the Egyptians out of slavery. And things kind of sort of muddle through. But at the same time, that tree of life, that whole thing, you don't hear a lot about it. In fact, the whole idea of the afterlife is really not a central aspect of Jewish history at all. I mean, they sort of talk about it a little bit in the Old Testament, but the whole concept of what is there an afterlife and so forth, it's really not an emphasis in the Old Testament. So then you have Jesus. Okay? And Jesus really described as the new Adam in one of the epistles is basically the person who's there to bring that tree of life back into action. Us having made this mistake, being kicked out of Eden, Jesus is there and gives us an opportunity to have that tree of life that we didn't have before. In fact, if you look at Revelation 22, 1-2, the actual verse is, "The angel then showed me the river of life, rising from the throne of God and of the Lamb and flowing crystal clear. Down the middle of the city street, on either bank of the river, there were trees of life, which bear 12 crops of fruit in a year, one each month, and the leaves of which are the cure for the nations." So, what's amazing to me is the tree of life that we got banished out of way back, and we're sort of living through that, Jesus is now giving us the chance to do that again. But unfortunately, it's not for everybody. It's only for the people who really trust their lives in Jesus and are not willing to be their own gods anymore. And that's I think, the thing that kept coming back to me, that the faith in Jesus is the ability to say, I don't want to be my, I, I I'm willing not to be my own God. I'm willing to work, and I'm willing to follow somebody who's much larger than me. And it's that humility that I remember learning as in my 20s, basically, and being able to sort of swallow it after fighting it and fighting it and fighting it, eventually able to swallow that and say, you know, I'm not going to make that same mistake Adam made. I don't need to be my own God. I can be part of what I really should be. And that is to be part of a servant with God, to be a child and not to be the God. Finally, when we get to heaven, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. There's going to be sort of singing and harps and all this other stuff. And I'm thinking, well, is that exciting to me? Is that really what I want to do? And the fact is, it is. Because a lot of times I have the wrong motivation in my life. I have a motivation to succeed, or I have a motivation that I get upset if somebody does better than me, or I get a motivation if, you know, I'm too busy to keep the Sabbath. But what I always have to struggle with is the concept that I am not my own God, that God is my God, and that I have got to continually, every day, basically realize that I shouldn't be doing that. I shouldn't be doing many of the things that I do. And I should be humbling myself to be the person that we were originally created, the Adam and the Eve that originally didn't know any evil and were willing to walk with God and talk with God every day. Thank you.